Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moment of the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. Hope you had a fantastic Monday. We're back in action now. Bhatia Unger Sargon, we've wrangled her up from Fox and Friends. She's in studio from Newsweek, author of Second Class, How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women. Bottom of the hour, Trey Yinks comes to us from Israel, where if you look at what our military is doing now, getting in position, if you see the conversations our defense minister, our defense secretary is having there with defense minister, you get the sense there's going to be a massive attack soon. And it looks like we have more assets in the region than we did originally when they hit us, when they hit Israel with 300 rockets and missiles. So we'll see what happens, what unfolds. And before we get to Bhatia, let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
It is difficult to ascertain at this particular time if there is an attack by Iran and or its proxies, what that could look like. But we have to be prepared for what could be a significant set of attacks.
John Kirby weighing in. On the war front, Israel braces for a multi-front attack led by Iran while Ukraine pushes into Russia, breaching their border for the first time since World War II. And it seems the whole war is about to reset. What do you think?
Number two.
You have a new form of crime. It's called migrant crime. I call it Biden migrant crime. Maybe I'll call it Kamala migrant crime. Kamala was the border czar. Now she's denying it.
Illegal immigration, a budget and criminal blotter burden from the streets of Massachusetts to the amusement park at Coney Island. Illegal aliens making Americans pay the price for their free pass and falling victim to their criminal past.
Number one.
What does the president see as the vice president's biggest achievement?
So look, because they've been partners, those achievements have been done. Certainly those historic unprecedented achievements have been done together. I'm not going to parse out anything from here.
I'll take that as nothing. Trump and Musk make news in an hour-long freewheeling conversation while Kamala makeover continues. However, we will not forget how little she has done and how determined the media is to make us forget it all and reset. Bhatia joins us now. Bhatia, great to see you.
Thanks so much for having
Again,
me,
I should say, before we talk about war, let's talk about what's happening right now. I mean, did people really expect us to buy that Kamala Harris has come out of nowhere, this young superstar that we haven't known for 3.5 years, if not more, if you lived in California?
The gaslighting is so out of control, Brian. And honestly, I'm despairing at it because there is a certain sector of the population that it really seems to be working on. But if you hold up things like headlines about Trump and then headlines about Kamala side by side, even on things that they're just saying the same thing, okay? Yeah. There was this great CBS, there were two tweets, one about how they responded to Trump when he said there should be no tax on tips, and then one how the same press, same journalist, same outlet responded to Kamala Harris when she stole Donald Trump's idea for no tax on tips. And for Trump, they were like, Trump proposes no tax on tips, which would cost the United States economy $250 million. And for Kamala, it was like, look at this innovative new idea. This could really help people at the bottom of the pecking order. It is so outrageous how they are trying to act. Tell us we don't know who this person is. And it's sad that it seems to be working.
So Trump was going out to eat and he was talking to this waitress and he said, well, you know, they're going back and forth on how hard it is to earn a living. And he said, well, you know, what if we had no tax on tips? And he decides to make it a policy and he rolls it out, talked about the RNC, talked about it multiple times. And then this is the headline with CBS had June 17th. Former President Donald Trump vows to stop taxing tips. It would cost the federal government up to $250 billion over the next 10 years. Okay. So Kamala Harris, without even saying that Donald Trump has this idea, and I think it's a good one, or I have a better one that's going to even go further. This is the headline. Vice President Kamala Harris is rolling out a new policy position saying she'll fight to end taxes on tips for service and hospitality workers. That seems to be a very positive headline. The other one seems to be, well, that's Donald Trump shooting from the hip, not knowing what's going on. The question is, if you're just going to run for the new Green Deal and you want to decriminalize border crossings and you want to stop with the fracking, fossil fuels, if you want to do that, just run on it. What I think is so terrible is that she wants to do all those things, but she's running differently. Not subtly. It's going to be dramatic. So if you elect something, you're not going to get what you think you're getting. One thing about Trump, you know exactly what you're going to get.
Right. And I think nobody embodies that more than Tim Walz, right? Because they literally cast him. He's out of central casting, right? He looks the part. He looks coach. Like a Midwest, exactly, Midwestern coach, grandfatherly, right? He looks the part. But you look at the policy he's enacted, it's far left. You look, Brian, at how he did with white working class people, people without a degree, and he did worse than Joe Biden, worse than Barack Obama. And meanwhile, I know I keep harping on this, but you look at someone like Josh Shapiro, who she could have picked. Josh Shapiro only lost the white working class in Pennsylvania by 2 points, okay? Instead of 25 points like Joe Biden, right? That was the guy to go with, the guy who had the record to prove he could speak to the working class. Instead, they chose the guy who looks in their mind like the stereotype of a working class person, but who put, you know, tampons in the bathroom, who supported a bill, Brian, that you can, the state can take a child from its parents if they don't support the child mutilating their body irreparably, right? And the whole thing, Kamala Harris, same thing. This is all smoke and mirrors. It is a production, as J.D. Vance put it over the weekend. This is a film. There's an Israeli expression, living in a movie, right? It means like there's nothing behind it. It's so amazing how it's all just surface.
So sooner or later, she's going to put up an economic proposal, put it online. And then she's going to, by the time the DNC comes out, talk about what she's going to do. So either she's going to explain why she changed her positions, or she is just going to pretend we all have short-term memory loss and think she didn't have those positions. Or she's got to throw Joe Biden under the bus and say, look, I had no voice in this administration. I was for a stronger border, but, you know, I couldn't do anything about it. And then when that bipartisan bill was kicked to his curb by Donald Trump, I had no choice. Now, meanwhile, we know she didn't visit the border, no interest in the border. Then when it came to voting rights, which was her second project, didn't show up and didn't have anything. That was a failure. Her third one was abortion rights, and she was not prepared with any plan to stop the overturn of Roe v. Wade, whatever you think of the overturn of Roe v. Wade. But here's one thing that I thought was interesting. Peter Navarro, a longtime staffer of Trump, said this, cut eight.
Trump doesn't need feasts now. He needs votes. And the current rally formula is simply not sufficiently focused on the very stark policy differences between him and Kamala Harris that will swing voters in key battleground states.
So it sounds like he doesn't like what Trump's talking about when he gets to the rallies.
Yeah, I think, look, anybody can understand why Trump is talking about the things he's talking about. It is enraging what they did to him. But I think that Navarro is absolutely right. Trump needs to be doing small sit-downs with voters in the Bronx, in Pennsylvania, in Michigan. He needs to go talk to auto workers and explain to them one-on-one or in small groups, in diners. Like, he's got to get back to that retail politics. He's amazing at the rallies, but those are kind of the same people following him from place to place. He needs to talk to voters, meet them where they are at. This morning on Fox and Friends, you guys had on Paul Jones, who wrote an op-ed for Newsweek. He's a young black man. He works in fracking, and he's like, this is why I'm voting for Donald Trump, right? And Lawrence asked him, he's a great question. He's like, what advice would you give Donald Trump? And he said, talk about the future. Talk about how you're going to put money in my pocket immediately from day one, because we're not thinking about the past. We're struggling.
Here's what Peter Navarro, Kevin McCarthy, Larry Kudlow, and Kellyanne Conway offered as advice to the president. Cut seven, former president.
You've got to make this race not on personalities. Mm-hmm. Stop questioning the size of her crowds and start questioning her position.
Trump doesn't need feasts now. He needs votes. And the current rally formula is simply not sufficiently focused on the very stark policy differences between him and Kamala Harris that will swing voters in key battleground states.
Don't wander off. Don't call her stupid and all kinds of names. Stay on message.
The winning formula for President Trump is very plain to see. It's fewer insults, more insights, and that policy contrast.
You can't argue with any of that, or can you take?
I think you can't argue with any of that. You know, you've been saying from the beginning he's got to keep it high. He's got to keep it classy. He is so popular among young people. He doesn't realize this, I think, that if he went into a barbershop, you know, in New York City, you know, if he went to Las Vegas and started talking to service industry workers, that's how you get people to turn out. That's how you get people to show up. You make them feel seen and heard. And I, again, understand why he's talking about what happened to him. It is outrageous what they did to him. He's got to get back to the part of they did it to me because they're coming for you.
Right.
And I think that that's gotten lost in the last two weeks.
Because you know what? The thing is, it is triumph what's happened so far with giving the stiff arm to a lot of these court cases or delaying them. But he also should realize, too, he's got the better policies. He's got a better track record. He's got a more popular presidency. He's got an inept person who can't really digest the issues, who can read a teleprompter, who's younger. But if he loses, all these court cases come back up, and you're not going to have the campaign funds to pay your legal fees. So it's going to be a lot worse for him, as well as Trump media will pay the price. We know that's now being it's on the open exchange. But this is what's maddening. The new image of Kamala Harris, tough on the border, cut 12.
Kamala Harris has spent decades fighting violent crime. As a border state prosecutor, she took on drug cartels and jailed gang members for smuggling weapons and drugs across the border.
I mean, come on, are you kidding me? She doesn't care about the border. She never went to the border. She worked in a sanctuary state.
Kamala Harris is a mirror image of what the blob thinks is the center of part of gravity in the Democratic Party, right? She has no independent convictions. She has no independent beliefs. She will do and say whatever she is being advised to do by this kind of deep state of, you know, inner circle, inner sanctum of Democratic, you know, high rollers and elites. And whatever they think is where the center of gravity of the party and of the voters are, that is what she will say. So in 2020, when they thought that it was in the sort of defund the police, you know, let people out of prison, right? Anti-prosecutorial side of things, the Soros side of things, that's what she said. Now they feel like, oh, maybe that's not so popular. Maybe we're in the woke lash. And so now she's going back to, I was a prosecutor, I was a cop, I was, you know, policing the border and all of these things. And it's just a pure reflection of their unwillingness to actually lead the country. They're always following what they think, you know, polling is telling them without having any real sense of what voters want.
All right. Bhatti's going to stick around a little while longer. At the bottom of the hour, we go back out to Israel and we find out about the latest as they wait on pins and needles with bomb shelters close by to see when the next challenge is going to come. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hear the ins and outs of the 2024 election right here. The Brian Kilmeade Show. From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean Podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
So just a quick, before we talk about a little bit about Israel, Bhatti Unger Sargon's here from Newsweek. Bhatti, J.D. Vance, I thought he was really impressive in these last three interviews. Ever since he got off the, this is what I said on my podcast 3 years ago, tour. Now he's back to fighting for the policies. I think he does almost a better job than President Trump fighting for his policies. What do you think he delivers in terms of Ohio, what he could deliver in Pennsylvania, what he could deliver in Michigan?
J.D. Vance is one of the only people in Washington who actually cares about the forgotten American because it's his mom. You know, a lot of people like to, you know, talk about fentanyl, this and that. He's somebody who is actually going to do whatever it takes to stop the poisoning of our young and older people. He has lived in those communities. He's experienced it firsthand. And you just can tell the sincerity that he brings to this issue. He cares about working class Americans. He cares about improving their lives, both the spiritual crisis that has our cities crumbling and the more economic crisis that's facing working class Americans. And you're so right, Brian. His sort of media tour this weekend.
Much stronger than Trump's, actually.
It was so great. It was so on point. It was so charming. And it was very aggressive, but without being rancorous. He was just incredibly adept at turning their hypocrisy on itself and revealing it for what it is. And it was great that he was on liberal channels because sometimes they won't let people on who they think can make the case persuasively for the other side.
Well, it's hard to turn down the running mate of a presidential candidate. Eve, it's hard to turn down a presidential candidate. I'm sure. I guess Kristen Welker got some blowback because she opened up on Meet the Press with Trump. I'm thinking, are you kidding me? The front runner to get the Republican nomination? How could that be blowback? I want you to hear what Senator Lindsey Graham said yesterday when he got word that there's over 1,000 troops. They say considerably more, but all I heard is 1,000 troops in Kursk, Russia, and they can't kick them out. In fact, they're digging in and moving forward. Cut 31.
What I think about Kursk, bold, brilliant, beautiful. Keep it up. Putin started this, kick his ass. Bottom line is to the administration, I appreciate your support. Let these people fight. Give them weapons they need to win a war they can't afford to lose.
So they use some of the Bradley vehicles to get through that border, and they know how to fight. And the Russians are scrambling to get some force reinforcements there to kind of save the area. Do you think this is a major change in this war?
I think it's a little too soon to tell. But as a companion to Lindsey Graham's comments, I was paying very close attention when Elon Musk and Donald Trump last night on that Twitter Spaces talked about the issue. Trump had very nice things to say about President Zelensky. He considers it a big favor that Zelensky defended him against the impeachment effort, right, over that phone call that they had. He feels very strongly that Putin would never have invaded if he had been president. And he talked about how aggressively he warned Putin against invading Ukraine. And he said, I told Putin what I would do if he invaded. And Putin said, no way. And I said, way. Like a really great Donald Trump moment. And that was really interesting to me, because this is now we're looking now at a situation that is ripe for Trump to come in and negotiate a peaceful settlement.
Because you'll never get the Russians to negotiate if they're on the offensive.
That's exactly right.
And they have 150 million people in a country against 46 million people, many of which, a lot of them have been killed. A lot of these towns have been destroyed. But believe it or not, when they do these polls in Ukraine, they don't want to give up one inch of land for peace. They still have the resolve.
Yeah, it's
which I don't know how they're going to get through.
Exactly. It's going to take a strong leader, somebody like Donald Trump, who can come in and say, listen, you know, peace is more important than that. There was a status quo when Putin invaded. Crimea was not part of Ukraine. It was part of Russia. The Donbas was independent and Ukraine was not part of NATO. And that's probably what we're looking at when we're thinking about a negotiated
settlement.
But
Crimea was part of Ukraine. They right because Khrushchev gave it to them
in 1965.
And
yeah,
he's like, that
yeah.
was a Putin says that's a dumb move. We're just taking it back.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, the America did not consider that to be a reason to get involved in 2014 when it happened. Right.
With Barack Obama.
Yeah.
So what's amazing, too, when you talk about the military aspect of this war, they basically destroyed the Russian Navy in the Black Sea with drones, without a Navy. They've pushed the Russians out and blown up their base in Crimea. It's incredible.
Yeah, this is the moment for a peaceful negotiated settlement and an end to this horrific, horrific carnage. I mean, half a billion men, I mean, 500,000 men now dead, they're saying, and the armies of both sides. I mean, you know what that does to a society to have so many young men.
Real quick, your sources say that they're expecting an attack in Israel?
I think so, yeah. But, you know, for Iran to actually go in heavy against civilian populations would be a big mistake. And I have a feeling they know that.
And even the Russians told them don't do that, which
Putin
is interesting because they aim at civilians. The Russians do when it comes to Ukrainians. Bati Ungar-Sargon, we'll make sure to read your stuff in Newsweek and the Free Press. And
yes,
watch
that's
and listen
right.
on the Free
yes,
Press.
Yes.
Thanks so much. Trey Yates next. Don't
Thank
move.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
We're continuing to watch it very, very closely. And it is difficult to ascertain at this particular time if there is an attack by Iran and or its proxies, what that could look like. But we have to be prepared for what could be a significant set of attacks.
And if you look at our assets in the region, obviously we think something's going to happen. You don't just do what we did to symbolic. I mean, we got nuclear subs. We have offensive capabilities in the region. We've got aircraft carriers. Obviously, we thought something was going to happen in 24 hours. Trey Yinks is on the ground. Fox News' chief foreign correspondent. I want to say policy, but you do policy as well as reporting. Trey, your thoughts about now as opposed to yesterday about an attack. What are they saying?
Yeah, well, thanks, Brian. Look, you make a great point. Israel has been bracing for days, fearing that a large Iranian attack could come and also involve the country's proxies like Hezbollah or the Houthis. And right now, it's really a waiting game. Both Israeli officials and American officials believe there will be some sort of attack. The question is, what will that attack look like? And then the second question is, what will the timing be like? Is this something that will happen before Thursday when regional parties are set to meet to discuss the possibility of a ceasefire to end the war in Gaza, or will it take place before? And so often with these stories, there's so much mixed reporting because officials don't have an exact idea. And it gives you a sense of the limits of American intelligence capabilities, because when you think about what the Americans are observing using their human intelligence, satellite images, and any other intel they can gather, they can see that the Iranians have ballistic missiles and drones ready to launch. They just don't know when the order will be given.
So very interesting, because what role do you think the fact that Iran has a new president in there? We keep on hearing that maybe this new president looked around and says, I don't even have a cabinet seated yet, or saw vulnerabilities there, and is talking to the Grand Ayatollah about saying, maybe we want to pause on this. Have you heard that?
The agreement right now in Iranian leadership. And we should note that traditionally the role of the Iranian president has not often been a decision maker in terms of the offensive military action taken by the Islamic Republic. That decision is made by one man, and that's the Ayatollah. And the Ayatollah Khamenei is someone who has shown just over the past several months he is willing to attack Israel. In April, Iran fired over 300 ballistic and cruise missiles along with drones toward Israel. So the question basically is now, will this new president, Masoud Pezeshkian, who was just sworn in a few weeks ago, will he be able to convince the Islamic Republic not to launch a wide-scale attack against Israel? And the short answer, according to most analysts, is no, he won't be able to do that, but he may be able to limit the response as to not drag Iran and the entire region into a broader war.
So what about this story that they're moving weapons into Jordan? I mean, Jordan would never give the green light to that, I wouldn't think, but weapons are moving into Jordan to create a yet another front. Have you heard that report? Is there any validity to it in your mind?
Yeah, and what's also interesting about this, when we look at the Iran-backed groups that are currently operating in the West Bank, in some of these larger cities like Nablus and Jenin and even Tulkarm, the small arms often were smuggled into the West Bank through Jordan. And so these organizations aren't just receiving funding and support from the regime, but also weapons that are being used in shooting attacks and by organizations like Hamas and Islamic Jihad in the West Bank. It's something that we rarely talk about, but it's a huge part of this story. There are thousands of Hamas and Islamic Jihad gunmen in the West Bank, and some of them are living and operating in towns and cities that sit literally just a few hundred feet from Israeli settlements and Israeli towns along the border. And so that's a huge part of this story. There are going to be a lot of questions about what can be done to clamp down on that flow of weapons. But as we look forward, the Israelis are bracing for the possibility of a larger attack first, and then they will deal with any of these smuggling operations second.
I understand, too, that Israel's already thinking about a counterattack or a preemptive attack should they have got concrete intelligence. No one doubts their intelligence. But do you sense that as much as Israel braces for retaliation, they're ready for their own version of retaliation?
Absolutely. The Israelis are prepared on multiple fronts, and we're told by officials here that they are not only readying preemptive strikes if they see that the launching capabilities of not just Iran, but also groups like Hezbollah are ready to go and going to fire, and they're also preparing for what the response will be. If there are attacks from Iran or its proxies on major Israeli population centers, we can expect a large-scale response from Israel, and this is the type of thing that could lead the region toward a broader war. And so as we look at that possibility, you also have to consider the fact that Israelis have been fighting a war inside Gaza for more than 300 days, and that war continues as we speak.
And the status quo doesn't work because, if you've told me before, there's about 80 to 100,000 people have been forced out of their homes, living in hotels, in undesirable situations trying to go to school and get a job, but they can't because they're in rocket range in Lebanon. So something's got to change there. The status quo, it does not work for Israel, correct?
Absolutely. It doesn't work for Israel, and there is growing political pressure on Israeli leadership for two things. One has to do with the situation in the north, understanding that there are tens of thousands of Israelis who are internally displaced still amid daily rocket attacks from Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. And then the situation with Gaza is open-ended right now. It's ongoing. There are still more than 100 hostages that remain inside the Gaza Strip. And there are real questions about what the war there is going to look like. What does the day after look like? And the Israeli people do want answers to those questions.
So Hamas arm wing has said one Israeli captive was killed when they bombed in Gaza over the weekend, and two female captives were wounded in a separate incident. They say by IDF forces. I'm sure you've heard that. How much of we believe it?
It's very tough to believe anything that Hamas says in these statements from Gaza. And we know this because we've spoken with hostages that were released from Gaza as part of the November ceasefire deal. And I talk about this in my new book, Black Saturday, that's coming out. We actually interviewed people who were released that were held in the tunnels beneath Gaza and then ultimately came home. And they described the psychological games that Hamas would play. They described the conditions that they were held in, and they were guarded day and night by Hamas gunmen. And so when someone's killed like that, as they're saying one of the hostages was, it was almost certainly a result of Hamas deciding to kill them for one reason or another. And that's part of what the Israeli military is investigating right now to determine the validity of that claim and also what exactly took place.
So from Israel, we're talking to Trey Yingst, from which could be a war zone very shortly, and we hope not, but we just have to be ready for anything because Iran's involved. So the other thing to keep in mind, too, and I don't think anyone ever qualifies this outside your reporting, anytime IDF hits a school, hits a mosque, hits a hospital, unless they come out and say it's a mistake, it's a headquarters. Why don't people ever put in context that Hamas makes the hospitals, the mosques, the playgrounds, the schools their headquarters? And eventually, if you want to get to them, you're going to have to hit that area unless you're going to have the human cost of putting the IDF on the ground and they're blazing their way through those and trying to blast their way through those streets.
This has been one of the hardest parts of the war to cover, to explain the true situation on the ground inside Gaza and the complexities of the decision-making when these airstrikes take place inside the Gaza Strip, because you see the horrific images that are coming out of Gaza, and part of the reason that the casualty rate is so high in the tens of thousands of people is a result of the fact that they are fighting Hamas in a very urban environment. Gaza is one of the most densely populated areas on Earth. And it's part of our role on the ground to ask the Israelis the questions in the aftermath of such a strike, as we saw this weekend. And that's exactly what we did. And I think this is a good example to talk about. There was a strike on a school building over the weekend. Now, yep. Of course, there was no school in progress, but there were people sheltering there. And the Israelis say that Hamas and Islamic Jihad were also using this facility as a command center. Now, when we ask the Israelis what a command center looks like, often the layman's language of this is it's a gathering of militants, and they're staying in this area. And so the Israelis decided to conduct a strike against this cell of militants, and they killed what they claim are dozens of them from Hamas and Islamic Jihad, and they have released the photos and names of those individuals. Now, what we do in the next step, and this takes some time, is I try to match those names to any sort of records, any sort of reporting. Who are these people? Can we confirm the identities? And that does take a lot of time. And so you're right. I always try to put this into context because the fog of war is real, and it's incredibly important to be patient with our reporting and make sure that we get to the facts at the end of the day. And in a war, especially a war of this scale, there are real uncomfortable realities of a conflict like this.
And that would be children in the line of fire, and basically should understand that Hamas chooses that because they know for the West to have civilians killed really weakens the cause. I don't care if it's America, England, or if it's Israel. When you see innocent people, we experience that with the Afghanistan-Iraq situation. When you get intelligence that there's a high-ranking terrorist in some mud hut somewhere, if there are kids there, they're going too. And for a lot of people, it's not palatable. For people that fight wars, it's unavoidable. So that's what people should understand, too, that they never wanted this fight. You got to go back to October 7th. It would be great if one of our leaders would qualify that. As bad as you feel that children or innocent people die, you have to understand who's responsible. It's the people that perpetrated the October 7th attack. That's the only reason why the IDF is there. Israel had no interest in going into Gaza. And lastly, does it? I know we started like this, but can you tell me, is it of two minds that Hamas is going to the peace meetings on Thursday in Qatar? They decide to represent, Israel will represent, William Burns will represent us. And at the same time, Iran is considering acting within hours. Oh, I always believe they're in concert. Am I wrong in that belief?
No, you're absolutely right. And some of the statements that we've heard from Hamas this week were actually simply to leverage the situation, because if Hamas had their way, there would be a large regional war with Israel. They want this pressure on the Israelis, and they're willing to continue the war if it means that Iran ultimately will attack. And that's why a lot of people are not optimistic about these talks on Thursday. And Hamas has also played a disinformation game, trying to describe their role in the Thursday talks as direct. And it was never supposed to be direct. This was supposed to be a conversation between American, Qatari, and Egyptian negotiators. Hamas came out with a statement this week saying they're not willing to participate in the talks. Well, they weren't going to participate in the talks anyway from the beginning. They're trying to leverage the situation to make the environment more favorable to their organization. And remember, at the end of the day, and this is something I think that gets missed in a lot of the reporting, Hamas wants to exchange Israeli hostages for Palestinian prisoners. And just yesterday, we talked about the November ceasefire deal, and I talk extensively about that deal in my upcoming book, Black Saturday. But when we talk about the November ceasefire deal, those hostages weren't released for free. They were exchanged for Palestinian prisoners, some of them linked to Hamas and Islamic Jihad. Just yesterday, there was a shooting attack in the West Bank that critically injured an Arab Israeli. The shooter was one of the people released as part of the November ceasefire deal that included the exchange of hostages for Palestinian prisoners.
And where was Sinwar, Trey?
Sinwar likely still in the tunnels beneath Gaza.
But where was he before
that?
The
only mastermind left in all of this.
He was in prison for how long?
Yeah, Sinwar was in prison for more than a decade. He was treated by doctors in Israeli prisons when he had cancer to make sure that he survived. He was released as part of a 1,000-to-1 prisoner swap deal for Gilad Shalit and ultimately went back to lead the Al-Qassam Brigades, the military wing of Hamas that launched the October 7th massacre. And so the Israeli people have a long memory. They know what happens in these deals. And it's part of the reason that especially the more conservative part of the political echelon in Israel is very resistant to any sort of trading hostages for prisoners.
And lastly, where is the Iran nuclear program? What do they mean it's weeks away from breaking out for a nuclear weapon? Could that be part of the delay? Let's delay, make people think we're going to attack, but announce we have a nuclear weapon?
So the Iranians are very afraid that the Americans and the Israelis are going to use the current situation in the Middle East as an opportunity to strike their nuclear facilities. And it's a reasonable fear, given the fact that Iran has been getting closer and closer to a nuclear weapon. They've said time and time again that they are only pursuing nuclear power for civilian use. It's a lie. It's a blatant lie, and it's a lie that has been documented by the IAEA, the UN's nuclear watchdog. The Iranians continue to increase the purity of uranium enrichment closer and closer to weapons-grade material, so much so that they have gotten to a point that not only did they receive a lot of money back to continue their nuclear program, but they are so close to a nuclear weapon that it would just take them a matter of weeks to decide to create a nuclear bomb. And they've shown, as we saw during the April attack against Israel, they have the missile capabilities to reach Israel. And so if they're able to attach a nuclear warhead to a missile and launch it toward Israel, even if it falls short, it would create chaos around the world. And so it's a very, very dangerous game that the Iranians are playing. And as they get closer and closer to a nuclear weapon, they are trying to drag out the situation as to not draw their country into a regional war and see those facilities destroyed, but also continue their nuclear program and hope that the result of the elections in November won't lead to an administration that is tougher on Iran. And I can tell you they are watching very closely to see what will happen in the United States.
Yeah, obviously with this election, that is pretty significant. Trey, thanks so much. Great perspective. I love when I can take some time and get your analysis. because it's invaluable. Trey Yinks, thank you. We look forward to your book, Black Saturday. You can pre-order it now. It publishes October 1st, but you'll get little excerpts the more you hear Trey on the channel. Thanks, Trey.
Absolutely. Thanks, Brian.
All right, 1-866-408-7669. I got some room on the other end. I'll see you in North Carolina, see you in Vermont, see you in Ohio when we come back.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
This law is on the books.
Yes.
Is Homeland Security enforcing the DNA collection law?
Not fully.
As a result, are Americans less safe?
Yes.
No question in your mind?
None at all.
Our team sat down with three government whistleblowers with 7 decades of law enforcement experience. They work at Customs and Border Protection, or CBP, a division of Homeland Security.
This internal government memo confirms that you were retaliated against because you spoke out against officials at Homeland Security who you believed were violating the law.
Yes, 100%.
The agency's intentional decade-long failure to implement a law designed to protect public safety. That's its conclusion. Customs and Border Protection is in violation of the federal law, and it's done knowingly.
Yes.
This internal Homeland Security directive, marked law enforcement sensitive, lays out the law. The border agency is required to collect DNA samples from non-United States persons in detention for immigration violations. Known as the DNA Fingerprint Act, it passed in 2005 with bipartisan support.
So there's no ambiguity. The language is clear.
It lays it out as a roadmap.
Have you ever seen a directive like this be ignored?
Never.
No.
Okay, a lot of people are going to be confused. Homeland Security's job is to uphold the law and to keep Americans safe. But what you're alleging is that Homeland Security is not complying with the law.
That's correct.
And all three of those guys that were talking to Catherine Herridge in our own website there were whistleblowers. And they were whistleblowers because they saw that the DNA kits that they were given to swab the inside mouth and find out who these people were when they crossed the border, if they actually were related to the kids they brought across with them, were not being used. I watched those DNA kits being used during the Trump era. This is a big sham. Why would they not want to find out who the terrorists are? That's a huge story. And these whistleblowers have been screwed in their careers and no one's protecting them.
Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest minutes of the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. We have a lot going on. I come to you from Midtown Manhattan, the site of two illegal immigrant crimes. One, you have on Coney Island over the weekend, you have a recidivist criminal who decides to rape a woman 9 o'clock at night. The accomplice from Mexico, the rapist is from Nicaragua. The accomplice from Mexico hits the boyfriend with a lead pipe, knocks him out, and then rapes her. And this guy's in arrest. The other one, do you remember in January of this year, you saw these migrants beat up two cops? Well, the ringleader of all of it gets jail and $50,000 bond, gets bailed up by a Lutheran church, and comes and gets arrested again, shoplifting. $500. So gets caught, and evidently he's been arrested more than once. This is the thanks we get from opening up our doors to all these illegal immigrants. Let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
It is difficult to ascertain at this particular time if there is an attack by Iran and or its proxies, what that could look like. But we have to be prepared for what could be a significant set of attacks.
John Kirby on the war front. Israel braces for a multi-front attack led by Iran while Ukraine pushes into Russia, breaching their border for the first time since World War II. And it seems the whole war might be ready to reset.
Number two.
You have a new form of crime. It's called migrant crime. I call it Biden crime. Maybe I'll call it Kamala migrant crime. Kamala was the border czar. Now she's denying it.
There you go, Donald Trump. He was on with Elon Musk yesterday. Illegal immigration, a budget and criminal blotter burden from the streets of Massachusetts to the amusement park at Coney Island. Illegals making Americans pay the price for their free pass and falling victim to their criminal past.
Number one.
What does the president see as the vice president's biggest achievement?
So look, because they've been partners, those achievements have been done, certainly those historic, unprecedented achievements have been done together. I'm not going to parse out anything from here.
Yep, that's it. Historic, unprecedented achievement. That's why he's got a 36% approval rating, and everyone told him you're not allowed to run and represent the party. Trump and Musk make news in an hour-plus freewheeling conversation while the Kamala makeover continues. However, we will not forget how little she has done and how determined the media is to make us reset and forget. Let's bring in Julian Epstein, serves as chief counsel of the House Judiciary Committee and staff director to the House Oversight Committee for Democrats from 96 to 2001. Julian, welcome back. What do you think of the makeover as we're watching it with the vice president of the United States?
Well, I think the Democratic strategy right now is to memory hole Kamala Harris, to memory hole what her policies were, and to memory hole sort of her meanderings, her soliloquies to nowhere, which had become fodder for late night comics and everyone else, and to sort of do a remake and to make the campaign a campaign about personality, because she's sort of, you know, she's very well suited for an internet meme campaign of personality, relative youth, relative carefree. And, you know, I think the mistake that Trump is making right now, Brian, is that he's playing into that. So when he claims that she's not really black, or when he claims that she's a DEI hire, or when he goes after the governor of Georgia, he's sort of making this a campaign of insult comedy and a campaign of personality. That plays right into her. The strength for the Republicans is to make this a campaign about issues, because Democrats are underwater on every single issue other than abortion. And if Trump makes this a campaign about the economy, it makes this a campaign about immigration, about crime, about the escalating situation in Iran right now, that's a winner for Republicans. But, you know, Trump has, since Kamala has risen to be the nominee, has sort of been flustered. He's been off his game, and he's getting dragged into the game that the Democrats want him to get dragged into, which is a campaign of personalities, which is a mistake for him.
True. I want you to hear what Charlamagne the God said, who's a big Kamala Harris supporter. In fact, when she was running in 2020, he was on the campaign trail with her.
They should have been having those backroom conversations with him a year ago. Yeah. Actually, they should have been having them 4 years ago. They should have been like, hey, you're a transitional president. You're here for, you know, a good time, mm-hmm. not a long time. And we are going to set up the future of the Democratic Party. They got a fantastic bench, you know, whether it's the vice president, you know, who's currently running, whether it's Governor Josh Shapiro, whether it's Gretchen Whitmer, whether it's Wes Moore, you know, whether it's Secretary Buttigieg, they got a great bench.
So they could have done this a year ago, and he just doesn't understand. He also doesn't understand why she's not doing interviews. He said, I really don't. So what I find, what I think is very unique about this race is that Kamala Harris knows how unpopular the administration was and the decisions are. So she's changing them, not personally, but through surrogates. So now she's going to enforce the border. Really? Now she's going to fight inflation. Really? The first day on the job. Now she is going to no longer push back against fossil fuels. Really? These are dramatic differences from how she ran and what she said. So if she really had revelations, near-death experiences, or has got educated, that's one thing. But there's no indication she has. She just understands her positions are unpopular. What do you do if you're Trump?
Well, I think you keep pushing the case that the Biden record, the Biden-Harris record, has been a record of failure, according to 2/3 of voters on nearly every issue. And I think you have to insist on the media that they have become very Bolshevik in not asking Kamala Harris to do what every other candidate does, which is face tough questions from the news media. You can't simply say, I'm taking the case directly to the voters. People want to know, you know, voters aren't, frankly, as important as the democratic process is. Voters are not going to ask a candidate the really, really tough questions for the most part. People want to know how she responds to a situation like what's going on in the Mideast right now with Iran, which is a another policy front that the Biden administration has really failed on. The Biden administration has tried to contain Iran, and it's largely been a failure because they've signaled to Iran the weakness of not wanting escalation, which just encourages Iran to escalate. Well, people want to know how she's going to respond to, you know, the in real time questions about what the U.S. policy ought to be right now. And I think they're hiding her for two reasons. I think they're hiding her and she's hiding from the press because, you know, you can reverse your position on one issue. You can't reverse your position on every issue that you took just 6 years ago. It suggests that you don't really have any worldview or you don't have any core beliefs. So I think the Democrats are worried about what happens when she is confronted with a reversal of position on almost every single issue she took. Almost every single position she took just 5 years ago. But they're also worried about, you know, she has her track record of not thinking quickly on her feet and, you know, sort of not answering questions directly and launching into these platitudes that are sort of just meaningless. You know, culture is a reflection of our moment in time, right? At present, culture is the way we express how we are feeling about the moment. Or the significance of the passage of time.
Right.
You know, all of these things, they are terrified that she will be seen as an empty suit if she's not able to answer difficult questions on policy issues. So, but I don't think this can last, Brian, because I think at some point the press builds you up and then they build you up to knock you down. And the first moment,
not this press,
there is a major slip up.
They just covered Joe Biden, you know, for 4 years and didn't say a word that you've been pointing out for at least two, that there's something wrong there, that he's not functioning at a high level and that he can't speak and he's got to make himself available. It's not okay not to do press conferences and interviews. You were pointing it out. So they covered for him until they couldn't anymore.
They did. And it was very Soviet-like. They did turn on him as well. And when they turned on him after the debate and when it became apparent that he was not capable, they turned on him and they insisted, you know, that he do an interview every couple of days. And then it was just, you know, KD bar the door. That same dynamic could occur with Harris. This strategy could backfire. If she gets out, when she does her first interview, if she flops, they're going to smell blood in the water. And then this strategy of keeping her in the basement or the witness protection program and not getting her out, this could backfire. There's 3 months to go before the election.
Right. So I want you to hear, these are some of those positions. These are some of the positions. This is not misstatements. This is how she feels. Cut 11.
We've got to critically reexamine ICE, probably think about starting from scratch. I am prepared to get rid of the filibuster to pass a Green New Deal. There's no question I'm in favor of banning fracking. And I'm actually feel very strongly about this, is that we need to have Medicare for all.
Assault weapons, right, that are already in circulation. What do you do about those?
Well, there are approximately 5 million, to your point, Craig. We have to have a buyback program, and I support a mandatory buyback program.
It's a little different, right? Those are different than what she's saying now. Although she's saying through surrogates, she's not in any of her speeches. So, and I'm sure that's not going to come up at the DNC. But I'm sure there's a lot of people on the left that you know that are that want the new Green Deal, want ICE banned, AR's banned, what they call assault weapons banned. A lot of them want that and are happy with those sound bites. But she knows the majority of the American people aren't. What do you do?
Well, that's the dilemma that the Democrats have right now. So the progressive left positions that, and she does not want to offend the progressive left, are highly unpopular. They're supported by about 6 to 10% of voters. So all of that list of issues you just read off, there is very little popular support for any of those positions. So she has the Hobson's choice when she gets out in the news media of saying, well, I reject those positions now. And then she tends to offend the far left. That's a fight that they don't want. But secondly, she is going to look hollow. It's fine to change your position on one issue. If you change your position on six issues, seven issues that you just held 7 years, 6 years ago, that's just not going to be credible. People just aren't going to believe that. So there's a risk of her coming off as phony when she tries to reverse every single position that she just held, you know, 5 years ago. But thirdly, people want to know what her explanation is, and can she explain in coherent terms from a policy or a philosophical point of view why she has made such a dramatic adjustment on so many issues? Or is this just a consultant-fed, poll-driven change that she's going along with and the Democratic Party are going along with to get through the election, but then they're really going to spring a far-left progressive agenda that the public doesn't support? And it's sort of, you know, another dishonesty with the American people in the same way the whole Biden is capable for a second term was dishonesty with the American people. So transparency is not what the Democrats are about right now. And that's disappointing to me because I think the Democrats should have moved to the center and should be very transparent about it. And they should have moved with a centrist candidate, in my view, and been very transparent. But transparency is not what the Democrats are about right now.
It doesn't seem like it. It would be, well, what do you think is the reason why Governor Shapiro is not the running mate of Kamala Harris?
I think the Harris campaign decided to bow to the far left anti-Israeli lobby that has unfortunately adopted the rhetoric and the arguments of Iran and Hamas, and you know, claiming that this is really about a two-state solution, when the irony is Iran and Hamas and Hezbollah could give a damn about a two-state solution, have no interest in a piece of land in the Mideast. I think this is an anti-Israeli and often a very anti-Semitic left that the campaign did not want to fight with.
No question.
I mean, Josh Shapiro's positions on Israel are not that much different from many others on the Democratic side, and even from Wallace's necessarily.
I would just love to see a Democrat just very pro-Israel understand that the only reason there's fighting in Gaza is because of what happened October 7th. The only reason a hospital or a mosque or a school gets hit is because that's where Hamas headquarters. Very simple. There's not one person, I think, on the IDF who wants to kill one civilian, where in Hamas, you ask them, they want to kill every Jew. They don't even care if they could not care less if they're in uniform or not. People should point that out that are on the good guy side. And I look at us as one of the good guys. Thanks so much, Julian. Great talking to you. We look forward to getting your insight from the DNC next week.
Right. Great, Brian. Thanks so much.
You got it. Daniel Bielak at the bottom of the hour. You're next. 1-866-408-7669. A lot going on today. Not just Kamala Harris waiting for her to talk. How's Trump going to handle it? Now he's got plenty of time. It's been a couple of weeks to reconfigure, to readjust. Is he ready? I think so. We'll talk about it when we come back.
Learning something new every day on The Brian Kilmeade Show. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Obviously, what's happening sort of overnight is they're rewriting history and making Kamala sound like a moderate when in fact she is far left, like far, far left.
Worse than Bernie Sanders. She is considered more liberal by far than Bernie Sanders. She's a radical left lunatic. And if she's going to be our president, very quickly, you're not going to have a country anymore.
So that was a bit of the spirit last night with Elon Musk on Spaces, and Spaces took 45 minutes to get up and running. I wouldn't know, but they said they were being hacked. It was supposed to, they did a test run. They had 8 million people capability. They had average about 1 to 2 million last night with Elon Musk, lasting over an hour. And it was interesting because Elon Musk, I think the headline for me was Elon Musk said, look, you got to get an accountability with government. The amount of money that comes in here, I'm really concerned about the debt. We all are. People with sensibilities about us worry about it. You don't want to cut off benefits. How much waste is in the government? He basically said, I would like to head up that task force. To me, that was the headline. And then Trump said, wow, that'd be great. And then he kept moving on. And he said, no, I would do. And he said, well, you're a big time cutter. I know what you do. You get these companies and you cut and you stream and you lean out. And that's true, whatever. How great would it be to get maybe America's finest businessman, inventor, creative mind to walk in? He probably knows the best cutters around, the Tim Cooks that, you know, Steve Jobs knew Tim Cook. He brought Tim Cook was an expert on expediting all this material out as quick as possible. He was a great organizer. He wasn't a great creator. I mean, how many Tim Cooks does Elon Musk know that might want to say to themselves, at this point, I got $100 million, you know, $1 billion. I want to get back to the government, almost like Kevin O'Leary. And, you know, obviously, Kevin doesn't have to work again the rest of his life, but he's intrigued by the possibility and creativity of what he could do for the country if you talk to him. I'm wondering how many people you could pull in like that who just want to say, I want to streamline government and get rid of programs that might be unpopular and not get you elected. But if you're a billionaire, millionaire already, who's got an expertise, and look at this as your form of charity, nonprofit, love it. Love it. I mean, people say all the time, if you look at the Pentagon, how much waste they have. We have $900 billion to the Pentagon. Great. How much is really going to weaponry, innovation, to the men and women who serve? Not nearly as much as it should be. And that's why I say I want to double the Pentagon budget, but I want to do it right next to a massive audit that has some type of implicit follow through where the recommendations have to be implemented.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
4 years ago, we were so respected. To a point where, when I said don't buy oil, they didn't buy oil, but they had no money, and Israel would have never been attacked. And again, I said to Vladimir Putin, I said, don't do it. You can't do it, Vladimir. You do it, it's going to be a bad day. And he said, no way. And I said, way. The Israeli attack would have never happened. Russia would never have attacked Ukraine, and we'd have no inflation. And we wouldn't have had the Afghanistan mess.
And that is what the president firmly believes. And he said the one thing he would have done that doesn't please Ukraine is the one thing that Russia hated was the fact that Ukraine really wanted to be in NATO, and they were indicating they were going to put him in. And that was what Trump thought, and people in Ukraine don't love, and for Zelensky hates it, that Trump wasn't going to be on board with getting into NATO because he felt as though that was the third rail. We'll never know because now they're at war for 2 years. Daniel Bilak joins us now, member of the Territorial Defense Force of Ukraine, spent most of the war in Ukraine. And Daniel, I'm so glad to talk to you because for the Ukrainians, after 2 years to go into Russia, into Kursk, really is sending Vladimir Putin head spinning. You could see it by his appearance yesterday when he told the local official, get it fixed. Basically, you do it. We're here to aid. It's up to you to fix it and basically kick the Ukrainians out. Are they able to?
Great to be on again, Brian. Well, you know, to this point in time, they haven't been. One of the reasons that I think we probably went in was to try to divert Russian forces away from Kharkiv and the Donbass fronts into Kursk to take pressure off our guys over there. But, they've started doing that. But so far, they've been using conscripts, border guards, which are part of the FSB, the old KGB, and Rosguardia, which is a paramilitary group. These are guys that beat up protesters on the streets. And you know, they seem to be having all sorts of command and control problems. And it's not really a joined up response. And our guys, you know, we had 1,000 Ukrainian soldiers in 3 days took more land than 90,000 Russian soldiers died for in 3 months. And we now control, according to General Sirsky, our commander on the ground, and President Zelensky, we now control about 600 square miles of Russian territory, which is just about what they've taken in the last 6 months.
So what's pretty amazing too. So the Russians had to say this is in control. But one of those mill bloggers, Risa Milblogger, claims that Russian forces were stabilizing the front line in Kursk Oblast. The Russian mill bloggers claimed on August 11th the Ukraine offensive activity decreased. However, a prominent Kremlin-affiliated mill blogger refuted these claims on August 12th and noted the Russian forces are far from stabilizing the situation, in part due to poor communication. So here we go. You got 1,000 guys, 300 miles or kilometers into Russia. And Vladimir Putin really doesn't know what to do with it. He continues to portray himself as an effective and knowledgeable manager of the situation. But this is embarrassing. And it harkens me back, Daniel, to the fact that when they decided, to when it looked like their special forces was turning on the country and they were turning around and going after the Kremlin, heading to Moscow, how deep they got before they were stopped. And it was the forces that turned around themselves, correct?
Yeah, I mean, this just shows again that a Russian army is much weaker than it appears and much more disorganized, and that, you know, they basically left the border unprotected. This has been hugely humiliating for Putin. I think that's probably part of the game plan here. And, you know, we're spreading panic inside Kursk and Belgorod oblasts. There's now been like 120,000 evacuees. And we've been taking tons of prisoners, people just throwing down their arms, most of them conscripts, Brian. I mean, they're not even supposed to be there. So, you know, this is sort of seems to be spinning out of control for him. But, you know, the wider picture is that the West keeps believing that Russia is this all-powerful hegemon. And, you know, we've just punctured that aura of invincibility that Putin spends enormous resources trying to project and successfully projects because he weaponizes the fears of the Biden administration and the fears of Chancellor Scholz and others into self-deterrence. And, you know, one of the reasons that that the border was unattended was because essentially the U.S. And some of the other allies have given the Russians sanctuary inside Russia to bomb us. I mean, we haven't been allowed to attack Russia with the U.S. Weapons to date. And so what they do is they put their planes up in the sky and they fire 500-ton glide bombs on Kharkiv, which is like 18 miles from the border, and obliterating entire apartment blocks and neighborhoods. And, you know, essentially, they've been, you know, our allies have ended up being Russia's enablers in allowing them to attack in advance in Ukraine. And, you know, all Putin sees is allied weakness when you do this. This self-deterrence means, hey, I'm succeeding. And then he doubles down. And so what we did was we basically told our allies and Russia, hey, guys, that's what we can do. And, you know, we've been fighting this war asymmetrically all along. We're not big enough and powerful enough to take the Russians head on because there's just too many of them, no matter how incompetent their army might be. They got a lot of kit and they've got a lot of meat to throw at us. But, you know, we try to be more nimble, more creative, more asymmetrical. And it throws them off. They can't adjust, and we've seen this over the past week.
So, talk about what's happening with the Russian Navy and what success you've had opening up the Black Sea and making their naval yard in Crimea uninhabitable.
Well, yeah, this goes to my last point, Brian, about the fact that we fought this war creatively. You know, we've actually the Black Sea is a great example. We have actually changed NATO doctrine on combined arms warfare, which holds that you attack with a combination of infantry, armor, artillery, and air power. Traditionally, that's been, you know, F-16s, A-5s, etc. We don't have an air force, so we've had to develop drone technologies. And what you're seeing in the Black Sea and what you're seeing in Kursk is the use of our technologies that have changed the nature and the course of the war in those two theaters. And if in Kursk, we are now actually advancing with drones coordinating each other, as well as coordinating the armor and the artillery and the infantry that's on the ground. You know, we packed into their speed cameras and shut down their eyes. They can't see us on the streets. We've used electronic warfare, EW, much more effectively. This Brian could end up changing the entire nature of warfare, let alone the course of this war. And your point about the Black Sea is absolutely right. We've sunk one third of the Russian Black Sea fleet without having a fleet of our own. We don't have a navy. And, you know, we're basically a drone navy. And
we've opened up the Black Sea corridor. We're exporting grain at the level that we were at the levels we were exporting back in 2021 before the war. And, you know, they're in Novorossiysk on the other side of the Black Sea because they can't use Sevastopol. And you know, if we were allowed, this is so crucial, if we were allowed to use ATACMS and the Storm Shadows and the Scalp missiles from Britain and France and the ATACMS from the U.S., we're still not allowed to use them on this offensive, this incursion in Kursk, this would be a game changer. We took out two airfields last week that would have been bombing the heck out of us in Kursk right now. And we did it with our own drones. We took out the Morozovsk and the Lipetsk airfields and detonated all sorts of these huge bombs, 500-ton, 1,500-ton bombs. But, you know, we're having to do this ourselves. If our allies didn't tie our hands behind our backs with the long-range missiles, this could be a very different scenario with us on the march and driving them out.
Yes, Dan, it's going to be an interesting year because regardless of our elections, people are talking about getting together with talks. Are you guys interested at all in talking to the Russians about a ceasefire?
Well, more to the point, the Russians aren't interested in talking about a ceasefire. What are we going to talk about? Because he thinks he's winning, and he's been, he's been enabled in this sense. By our allies, because he's been given sanctuary in his own country. I mean, I think that we would talk with the Russians once we have them on the back foot. And gotcha. The only way to get there, Brian, is to make the cost of this war unbearable for Putin.
And maybe it's starting, Dan. Dan Bilak, thanks so much from Ukraine. We have the latest coming up next. Stuart Varney will simulcast and then take some calls. Don't move. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Now, the Brian Kilmeade Show joins Fox Business's Varney and Company with Stuart Varney, live on your radio and on Fox Business. Here's Brian Kilmeade.
Yeah, well, welcome back. I'll be right with Stuart Varney in a moment on FBN. You're going to love it. If you don't have it, you just flip over to it. If you're listening on, you can get it on Sirius. You could also get it online. You get it on the app. And we're actually seen on Fox Nation, too. With Stuart Varney, we're going to be talking about this election. You know, it's the time he's business, but he also talks about how the election affects business. And I'll be talking about Kamala Harris and how we really don't know anything about her. But the one thing that comes up, too, is what some of the people that her husband and he have donated to, which is about to come up now. Listen.
We have a cooling inflation numbers this morning, and clearly the stock market likes it. Dow's up 155. 10:51 Eastern time. That means it's Kilmeade time, and he joins me now. Brian, Carrie Jean-Pierre was pressed about Harris's flip-flopping on the border. Here's a clip.
How long have you guys known that Vice President Harris does not think President Biden is doing a good job at the border? She has a campaign ad where she is saying they need more Border Patrol agents. If President Biden's doing such a good job, why do they need any more border agents?
We both believe that. The president does want more Border Patrol agents. You know who's getting in the way? You know who's getting in the way? Republicans in Congress, they're getting in the way. You know who else is getting in the way? The former president, Donald Trump, he's getting in the way. I mean, there's no daylight here.
You know, Brian, she's getting away with it. She's flip-flopping on all kinds of things, whether it's the border, whether it's whatever. She's getting away with it. What say you?
Well, I just love, too, there was a sheriff in one of the ads that Kamala Harris says she cracked down on trans gangs and cartels. And no one knows this. And the Border Patrol, who's seen in the ad during her ad, said, I want out of it. Cease and desist with showing it. You've never been tough on the border. If you walk up to the Border Patrol people and say, how's this administration been? They don't have their back. They've been outnumbered. They don't get the support. Mayorkas has been a joke. They got rid of Remain in Mexico. They stopped with the DNA kits. I don't know if you've seen it, but Catherine Herridge used to work here, came out with three whistleblowers who came forward saying, I worked on the border. And we were not allowed to use the DNA kits. We weren't even test swabbing the inside of their mouth to find out if that man walking with that little kid is related. Trump guy came down with those DNA kits. And after a while, all they had to do is hold up the swab and the men would come clean if they were actually child trafficking. But now they were told by Mayorkas, back off. And their careers have been destroyed because of it, given desk jobs have been forced to get fired. Okay. So we're talking about nobody I know thinks they've been good on the border. And if you wanted that bipartisan deal that Senator Lankford cut, which said, you know, it's got some positives in it, But Trump says, I can't do twice. I don't like this. I want my own. Let me have this in 7 months. I don't want to sign off on what Biden signs off on.
Another story. Financial disclosures reveal that Kamala Harris and her husband, Doug Emhoff, repeatedly donated to both anti-police and pro-sanctuary city nonprofits. That as Washington, D.C. struggled with rampant crime. React to that, please, Brian.
Well, it just shows you where they really stood. And remember in 2020, she was urging people to put money into bail to bail out some of the rioters that were jailed for destroying property and burning buildings. That was where she stood. And she was for defunding ICE. She was for very anti-policing. She was talking about slashing police budgets across the country, even though they were in high crime areas, instead sending in social workers with them. That's who they are. Follow where their money is. That's who they are. And we understand, too, do you know any areas in which she is really welcomed by law enforcement? And what's going to happen is the law enforcement and their families, they understand that no matter what Kamala Harris says now, we watched her as a DA, watched her as an attorney general, and then watched her as a senator and watched her as a vice president. Nobody thinks she's pro-police. And now we see where her and her husband, where the money goes. So just so you know, if she becomes pro-police, she alienates another part of the community. I guess she wants to win over. It would be great if she let us know where she stood and if she changed her mind, why?
Look, the cover-up will go on because the media wants it to go on. The media will allow it to go on. And that's what's happening right here. Brian, sorry I'm out of time, but thanks for being with us. As always, we'll see you again later.
Go get him, Stuart.
I want to thank you, Charlie, for appearing on the show.
See you in the hall. That's just one thing to come up with. The one thing that Trump's just got to be very clear. When it comes to law and order and when it comes to the military, you cannot tell me that even though Governor Walz is in the military for 24 years, he's going to get the military vote. He's just not. You're going to tell me that whatever you think of Donald Trump, you like to say crime is down. Nobody thinks it's down. The violent crime is down when it comes to murders and body bags. That's true. Probably you can't really make up those numbers when it comes to burglaries, when it comes to enforcement, when it comes to arrests. If you know in Chicago, in New York, in San Diego, in Philadelphia, in Los Angeles, that if you make an arrest, they're going to come out the same day. A lot of times you don't bother. Why? Because it's a ripple effect. Because you also understand that without qualified immunity, while you go to make that arrest that's going to result in that person being booked and released, you know there's always a risk. You're going to get into a tussle and possibly get sued if you come out on top while that person ends up a little bruised. So all this compounds to less arrest. Wow, I get less in prison. Wow, I guess we're getting on top of crime. No, it's a ripple effect. But if you ask people if they feel safe, nobody in Washington, D.C. feels safer this year than last and 2 years ago or 3 years ago. Every year it's gotten gradually worse, even if they wanted to convince you that the numbers are actually better. But we'll see about that. We know that Kamala Harris is taking pretty much the rest of the week off for being a vice president. Walz is doing a lot of fundraising. He's going to deliver remarks at the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. They're going to be voting for him. He's also going to go to collect money in Newport Beach, where the mayor says he's welcomed, but he will showcase a city of conservative values that didn't defund the police and would never allow protesters to burn local businesses to the ground. That's a quote from William O'Neill. He said that he decreases debt and increases quality of life here, that did not allow protesters to burn local businesses, and cares about human flourishing. If Governor Walz is interested in learning policy from a well-run city, then he is in a when he is here for political donations, my door is always open. Yeah, remember Trump had that huge fundraiser and it caused a big uproar, caused stop traffic over in Newport. That's that a conservative enclave in Orange County, California, really is so much different than everything else. And we'll see, because remember, if the House is going to stay red, they're going to need a lot of converts in California and New York. They got them last time. Will they keep them this time? Brian Kilmeade Show.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show, coming to you from New York City, home of the illegal immigration issue like no other before. You got stabbings going on at Randall's Island where we're keeping thousands of illegal immigrants, 67,000 overall. You got the Marriott suing. The Marriott suing this other hotel that had the Marriott franchise name because without telling the Marriott franchise, they converted it to a legal immigrant hotel and got a lot of money from the city to do it. By the way, your tax dollars, you know, they tax me in the city even though I live on Long Island. And then you pay New York taxes. So you got city taxes, his taxes. And then you got, of course, the federal taxes. This is one of the reasons why people leave the cities. So now you have an uncomfortability. I don't know if you heard over the weekend, Coney Island, you got a woman that got raped, her boyfriend hit with a lead pipe, 9 o'clock by a recidivist criminal, one from Mexico, one from Nicaragua. Then you got a Venezuelan here who beat up two cops and was part of it, was put into jail and was bailed out by a Lutheran church in the area. And that Lutheran church posted the $50,000 bail and he goes out and he commits two more crimes. Isn't that great? That is what New York is right now. But it is packed. It is still, there's still fantastic places here, but it is a place where I don't care what they tell you about the numbers, and maybe it's your city too. There is no way this place is safer than the, as the numbers indicate. And that's the main thing. Pete Buttigieg the other day said, look, the crime numbers are down. He does it from Washington, the carjacking capital of the country, along with being the capital of the country. This hour, we're going to be joined by Cameron Arcand. He's an Arizona campaign reporter for the New York Post. Also, I'll be taking your calls at 1-866-408-7669, and we'll find out if there's more to know. Cameron, welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Thank you.
Hey, Cameron, what's with this Mesa mayor, a Republican, coming out against Trump? What's behind that?
So this is not new with John Giles. He is repeatedly endorsed Democrats in the past. This is kind of part of the contingent of a group of Republicans in the state or former Republicans in the state who are now backing Democrats. You'll see oftentimes in their speeches, they'll make reference to the late Senator John McCain, now ambassador to Turkey, Jeff Flake, who used to be a senator of Arizona. And so they're trying to court disaffected, but you're also seeing a counter campaign on the Republican side with this, with Carrie Lake also launching her own kind of former Democrats and Democrats for Carrie Lake coalition in the Senate race as well. And you're seeing this with Ruben Gallego, too.
So right now it's Carrie Lake, who was the rock star last in the 2022 when she's trying to run for governor. Still can't believe she lost. She can't believe she lost, too. And Lake is currently trailing Gallego, who's got a well-known name as being a congressman there, by about 3%. Is that a gap that can close?
I think it can. And the best thing in terms of if you are the Lake campaigning, you're looking at this, is Trump is pulling ahead of her. And because they are so closely aligned, that could serve as a benefit to her at the top of the ticket, could pull her up in that sense. But the thing, too, to keep in mind is you look issue by issue. What are the top things? It's the border. It's the economy. It's fentanyl. How are these issues going to impact this race here in Arizona? And those are things that could potentially have a positive impact, even if she is down in this race. But it is still very much extremely competitive.
It is. But what's crazy is Harris is trying to pretend that she's tough on the border. Even Senator Kelly, I mean, I was shocked that he has not been more aggressive on the border as somebody with that military background who wasn't deep, like knee deep in Democratic politics. But Harris is actually running as if she's strong on the border. Cut 12.
And Kamala Harris has spent decades fighting violent crime. As a border state prosecutor, she took on drug cartels and jailed gang members for smuggling weapons and drugs across the border.
We know she didn't do that. Everything she did was symbolic. The people on the border know that she is not strong on the border. Are people really open to making her look like tough on the border?
Well, here's the big question people need to ask as voters. The Democrats are pushing right now for a congressional fix to the crisis. And then they went and did, they're touting the executive order on asylum or whatever they want to call it, 3 years later. And so they're wanting a congressional fix to an executive order related problem. And that is the thing that voters need to be looking at. during this. Do they think a congressional fix is the right move? Do they want kind of an immigration overhaul that they're looking for in this category? But, you know, I've been down to the border a few times, not the cute parts where, you know, it's a legal port of entry. I've been down to some of these areas where it's the gaps with cartel spotters, and it's rough out there. There's big gaping holes. There's material left off to the side from the border wall that was being built during the Trump administration. And you talk with the ranchers down there, and their property values have tanked. There's garbage everywhere, and there's significant crop damage. And even talk with Democrat mayors, and they're agreeing with this. This is a bipartisan issue, but the solutions, that's going to be something that voters are going to be needing to be looking at.
So how has it gotten better since the executive order?
The arrests have gone down, but it's still a crisis. And that's the thing, is there are still so many aspects of this that are still going on. I always hear about, well, fentanyl is mostly trafficked in by U.S. citizens. That's true. But the border agents are so overwhelmed dealing with the influx of migrants that they can't take care of the legal drug interdictions to the level at which it's been done. This came out a couple of weeks ago that the biggest fentanyl seizure in Border Patrol history happened a couple of weeks ago in Arizona, where they seized, it was just an insane amount of fentanyl. This is a regular common occurrence, and the big question is, are they catching all of it? And the answer is no.
Here's what President Trump said last night with Elon Musk, Cut 23.
You know, this is migrant crime. This is crime that's going to be, yeah. And I saw it today in New York where somebody was knifed, where they raped the girlfriend of a man that stood there watching in New York in one of the shelters. And started sure. pulling out the knives, and bad things happen today. But this is happening every day.
So, I mean, are you seeing the crime that these cities are seeing?
Well, it's pouring into the Phoenix area. We're about 2.5 hours away from the border. And every week you hear about either a fentanyl seizure or crime-related problem here in the valley related to illegal immigration here in the state. And it's a widespread issue. It's, you know, it's kind of hard to deny that at this point, especially when you have billboards. We had billboards up for a while that say one pill can kill. And that's the thing that's really hurting people here. It's the drug problem. And, you know, that's impacting everybody, Republican, Democrat, Independent. We're all being impacted by it.
So is there a danger during when McCain was running for re-election? They said there was a real danger when you talk strong on the border that you're turning off the Hispanic population. I feel like that ship has sailed, but you're there. What do you think?
I don't necessarily think that matches reality with it all, especially when you consider that the border communities being impacted, many of them are heavily Hispanic. And then we also need to consider that, you know, it's so interesting when we talk about minority outreach. All of these issues matter to different groups at once. It's not a cut and dry thing. The economy matters to everyone. The border matters to everyone. If you're waking up and you're seeing something each morning that you don't like to see, the guy next door that's a different background than you is seeing the same thing. And I think we're such a diverse state here in Arizona, one-third Democrat, one-third Independent, one-third Republican, where to cut across certain lines could matter on some issues, but I certainly wouldn't be shying away from anything if I was any campaign.
Cameron, what about the abortion amendment that's going to be on the ballot this year? What kind of impact will it make? Where does the population of Arizona stand on this, which is still, I understand, majority Republican?
Yes, I could see a world right now where, because that amendment will be further down the ballot, that it might have less of an impact on the top of the ticket races. But it's still going to play a major role. This has been something that Democrats have been campaigning heavily on. It does show that this does kind of strike a nerve with some moderate voters, the abortion issue. So it could play a significant role, especially because we had a time frame in Arizona where our abortion laws were unclear at the state level. They repealed the past law. And so now they're using that fuel, using that funding, using that energy on the Democratic side to organize and use that on this issue, not only for the amendment itself, but also for their candidates.
So with all the election mess and the integrity issues that Republicans claim happen in Arizona, What is that like, bringing that issue up to candidates and to citizens and to voters today? Is that something that, that strikes a nerve, a raw nerve with everyone in Arizona? Because in Florida, if you brought up election integrity for years, starting with the 2000 with Gore Bush, they were really embarrassed by it. Where does Arizona stand?
I would say it depends on who you ask on the issue. It's still very much a big issue amongst Republicans. Among the moderates and Democrats that I know, it's less of a significant issue. But the big thing I hear even from Republicans is this sense of wanting a sense of clarity and wanting a sense of what is the best way to navigate the path forward on election issues. And how is that being communicated to the public? How do they feel that their vote is making sure it's felt secure? How are they, how are recorders' offices at the local level communicating with the public on the issue? So that's the thing, is regardless of whether where you stand on the issue, the common thing that I see is the strong desire for clear messaging from local governments on it to make sure that people feel that their vote is safe and secure.
Have you guys done anything like Georgia has to fix the time it takes to count your ballots?
There was, I believe, a legislative kind of fix. I think some people argue that it now takes longer. It has to do with where the ballots are getting tabulated, at least in Maricopa County. But the thing that I really like to emphasize with Maricopa County is it is the second largest voting jurisdiction in the entire country. I believe we're behind L.A., second or third largest, and that plays a huge role into why it takes so long. You look at Deep Blue Los Angeles, they take, I remember I used to live in California, they take for a really long time to count by virtue of the amount of people that live there. And so when you have that in a competitive area like Maricopa County, it takes a while because of the amount of people. It's a real nail biter. So the big thing that they're always pushing is, you know, go and vote early, because those are going to be the ballots that drop once you see that. So it probably will this year take a bit of time, but it does have to do with, you know, consider the amount of people that live here too.
So Cameron Arcand is our guest now. He's the Arizona campaign reporter for The Post. Cameron, right now, have you got a sense of how Harris and Trump match up?
So it is a nail biter. I will say that. I think on the issues, I believe that Trump does have a slight edge, and he does have an edge in the polling right now. You look at the Real Clear polling average, that 1 or 2% of a lead. But Harris was here last week, and, you know, it was a fairly large Democrat rally. Doesn't compare with Trump sizes, but when you're a Democrat, you're used to kind of the, you know, it's a different kind of situation on their side. So there's definitely a sense of momentum on the Democrat side for Harris in Arizona. But once again, you look at the issues, you look at polling, and this is going to be an incredibly tight race. And it could change over the next few months, depending on how that messaging plays out here on those issues you and I are just talking about.
They said it's 1.5 on the Real Clear average, but Cook Political Report calls it a toss-up. So we'll be talking again. Cameron, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You got it. 1-866-408-7669. We're going to watch Arizona. Most of all, I just hope these states get it right. I don't want to hear the controversy, if at all possible. You showed me in Georgia you can fix it. You showed me in Florida you can fix it. Please fix Arizona. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hear the ins and outs of the 2024 election right here. The Brian Kilmeade Show. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Trump has kind of been thrown on his heels by this, and he's not really sure how to go after Vice President Harris. He knew his attack lines on President Biden. He really has struggled with how to go after someone who's 20 years younger than him, who is a different gender, a different race. It's kind of been this moment where he has not been able to coalesce around a single attack line.
I know you guys are objective over there, that you just report the news as it is.
Oh, I know. CNN makes a... I know.
Is that supposed to be a laugh line?
I wasn't supposed to be, but I guess it is.
That was great. So Caitlin Collins has his cell number, called him when she was in an Uber, or he called her, whatever it was. You know, she used to work for the Daily Caller. You know, I know her a little bit. She does a good job. But That is great, that reaction by, of course we know what CNN is. Of course you know what CNN is.
No, I know. And just like Colbert saying that sincerely, then the audience just laughing. But by her then saying that's supposed to be a laugh line, like, it just made it all so much worse.
It was so great because they're oblivious that we know. They're oblivious that we know. Like if Sean Hannity was sitting there and they said something like, well, you know, you got a call from Joe Biden to say Donald Trump's out of the election. That would be a laugh line. Sean would laugh at it because Sean's not. He'll say, I'm a conservative columnist. Excuse me. I'm a conservative commentator. I'm a conservative host. And I'm friends with Trump. Like, so he would, there wouldn't be a laugh line. It would be, he would laugh with it instead of being shocked by it. But I mean, if you see MSNBC is so over the top, it's comical. What I laugh is Michael Steele and Joe Scarborough, who pretend to be Republicans. So they sit on the set and they say, well, look, these Republicans feel the same way. They are absolutely rooting for Kamala Harris. And Michael Steele over the weekend came out and said, he was a nice enough guy. Remember, he was there when Romney, he was heading the RNC when Romney was there. Michael Steele came out and said, there is no reason why she has to take any questions. Why would you be on that channel pretending to be a host, anchor, reporter, whatever, and not want to talk to the person who could be president of the United States? Instead, you'd rather her read to you. You'd rather have the president of the United States read to you. I want you to read me what someone else wrote that you say you're going to do, because I don't believe you're going to do it, and I don't care what you do. I guess it's because I work at this job, and that's what MSNBC is. But, I mean, there's tension at NBC between NBC News and MSNBC. CNN is barely a network now. I don't know if they're even trying. So that's why most people watch us. I don't think we've ever had a better lineup. I don't think we've ever had a more insight. And I don't think you have to flip channels to get other opinions. I mean, what do they want me to do today on Martha?
Oh, did we? They want to talk to you and Jesse Tarlov, so two different opinions.
On whatever, probably these two.
Yeah. I think it's something like that. I have to look it up specifically.
Yeah, but that's what this channel does. I mean, you watch Neil Cavuto. We have, you know, Harold Ford I was next to yesterday on The Five. And he came out and said that she thinks it's a great compliment for Harold Ford said it's a great compliment for Kamala Harris to take Donald Trump's idea on tips and make it part of her policy, too. Now, that to me is comedy. You got to be kidding me. If you're going to take someone's policy and make it a compliment, at least you should compliment them. You say, hey, the other day in June, I saw that Donald Trump is not going to tax tips anymore. I think that's a great idea. And as Dana Perino said, and this is what I'll do in addition. But she never acknowledged it. She takes it and says it to the same in the same state in which Trump announced it. The next thing they're going to try to take Social Security, where you said seniors shouldn't be paying taxes on it. That will help them immediately. And maybe build a wall. Maybe she'll decide to build a wall. That'll be fun.
I love Venn diagrams.
Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Joe Biden is a failed president. She was a failed vice president. The worst president in the history. The worst vice president in history. He is incompetent. She's incompetent. Everything he's touched has been bad. Everything she's touched has turned to bad things.
She can't talk.
She can't talk.
In many ways, he's worse than Bernie.
She's worse than Bernie.
Low IQ. He's a low IQ individual.
She happens to be really a low IQ individual. She really does. She has a very low IQ.
Yep, and that was Trump being, there was a montage put together by Jon Stewart on his one day a week that he works on The Daily Show. It's pretty funny and true. And part of the reasons is people that really like Trump think that Jon Stewart's 100% right. Stop with the attacks. You got to change your tactics judging by your opponent. And the thing is, this is what works to Trump's benefit, and you know that. He's using common sense, not conservative principles. It drives conservatives crazy, but they're used to it by now. And what he does is, what's it going to take here? What's it going to take here? What's it going to take here? What do we bring peace in Ukraine? I'm going to get these guys at the table. That takes off some conservatives. What is going to happen with Israel? There's one good guy here. It's Israel. That's a story. End of story. When it comes to spending, when it comes to when it comes to Social Security, I'm not touching it. That ticks off some conservative. When it comes to Medicaid, I'm not touching it. I'm going to figure out other social programs to cut, not what people are counting on. And I have news for you. If he likes poor people, the policies that his core policies and principles get 60% approval rating. But the minute you become, well, is she really black or is she really Indian? They love that. Democrats love that because you no longer have to talk about this liberal DA from California who is a failed presidential candidate, who is a throw-in as a vice president, who never did anything distinguishable and failed epically at where Trump's strengths is at the border. So when John Stewart does that, he's not doing it for this reason, but he's actually helping the Trump campaign and people that want to see him be successful stop with the personal attacks. It worked against Hillary Clinton originally. I think against Joe Biden, he was destroying himself anyway. And now with all the corruption that came out that we found out later with the laptop, everything proved true. But with Kamala Harris, you got 80 days. You don't have a year to say she's corrupt or did this. You got all this tape and all this video and all this commentary. You got to get, it's not just Trump. You have to have Tom Cotton, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz when he's not fighting for himself. You have to have the best advocate is J.D. Vance, Governor Burgum, fanned out everywhere, taking on the arguments because they're easy arguments to make. Where Trump gets his surrogates in trouble is when he attacks Kamala Harris personally, professionally, for the gender perspective, calls her crazy, calls her not really black. Then you get Tom Cotton on, who wants to talk about foreign policy or immigration walls, and they end up saying, why did he say that? And they can get themselves out of it, but instead of getting out of it, why not lead to it on policy? Like, what does she stand for? How about this? Surprise me. Eric says I pulled some montages of some things that she said that, let us say kindly, are unorthodox over the years.
Ukraine is a country in Europe. It exists next to another country called Russia. Russia is a bigger country. Russia is a powerful country. Russia decided to invade a smaller country called Ukraine. So basically, that's wrong.
Okay, that really helpful. Do you feel better now if you're Zelensky? Wow, I hope she becomes president. That's why she goes to Poland and was asked about the difference now with America saying, I will allow you to use F-16s from not ours. Poland says, America, give Ukraine F-16s. So she's having a press conference with President Duda. And then he gets a question, what's going on with the F-16s? And there was total silence. And then President Duda says, okay, I'll take it. And then she says, a friend in need is a friend indeed. No, that's not the answer. When you talk about war, life and death, refugees, invasion, first time since World War II, you have Eastern Europe under threat, multiple fronts, Baltic nations extremely concerned. They could be taken in a day, and they know it. Is America going to be there? You got this giggly vice president on the national stage who probably doesn't even know what country she's actually in. Any more?
I have a particular fondness, I must tell you, for electric school buses. I love electric school buses.
Yep. That says a lot. Kevin McCarthy in California, seeing Kamala Harris come up, seeing her do the talk show circuit, sees that she bonded with Barack Obama early, saw that she was a rising star, and then watched epically as she failed as a candidate in 2020 and looked on the, I guess, the washed up pile until she was saved by Joe Biden, who said, I want a minority. Clyburn promised Clyburn a minority and a woman. It left really Kamala Harris and Karen Bass, and she'd had a better background check. Kevin McCarthy, Cut 14.
Everybody in Congress, whether you're Republican or Democrat, we all talk about those few offices that have high turnover, 92%. Those are the toxic people. People don't want to work for, they don't want to work with on legislation. And she's been known for that. I have a number of Democrat members from California who would talk about her and talk about how staff came to work for them because they couldn't work for her. This isn't like a Republican leaving a Democrat staff. These are people who walked in, wanted to believe in the individual, but it was so toxic, had to depart. And if you have a 92%, those are the people we look in Congress probably won't stay there very long.
Right. And some of the staffers, as they left, they said they never saw a more disorganized team that had no objective or plan to win. James, listen on KCRS over in Odessa, Texas. Hey, James.
Hey, Brian. Hold on just a second. I am so sorry. Let me get you off my speaker here, buddy.
I couldn't even tell you were on speaker, but go ahead. All right, go ahead.
Yeah. So, Brian, here's bottom line for me. I love to hear your perspective. If Trump loses this election, the only person he can blame is the person he sees in the mirror. It is his to lose. Ronald McDaniel is not running RNC. His family is. He had all the momentum. Everything is in place for him to win. If he loses, it's from him.
I do agree with that. And the Wall Street Journal said the same thing in their editorial section. They say, you know, Donald Trump, even with the pandemic, was en route to win. But he did some things down the stretch late that hurt him with the overall vote. And that will he do it again with so much at stake for him personally? You know, James, they're going to go after him. The legal stuff is going to start again if he loses. So he should listen to the people around him. He's got a fantastic team around him. Chris LaCivita is fantastic. Susie Wiles is great. Jason Miller really understands him and is a great communications person. She's got two people speaking out front that are very strong. All he has to do is have message discipline. Stop with the nicknames, talk about the policy. And I need some ads. She has so many things that she has said in the past that make her look idiotic because she doesn't study and doesn't know the issues. And I'll give you a case in point. These are the issues that she's flipped on already. And thanks for the call, James. You can still listen. This is what she's flipped on in the past. She wants us to flip on now, and she's going to clarify and lock in at the DNC. Please don't forget this. Cut 11.
We've got to critically reexamine ICE, probably think about starting from scratch. I am prepared to get rid of the filibuster to pass a Green New Deal. There's no question I'm in favor of banning fracking. And I actually feel very strongly about this, is that we need to have Medicare for all.
Assault weapons, right, that are already in circulation, what do you do about those?
Well, there are approximately 5 million, to your point, Craig. We have to have a buyback program, and I support a mandatory buyback program.
Okay, so she gets Tim Walz, who's a hunter, evidently, and has a rifle, okay, and she thinks that gives her cover. Well, she's got to say, I was wrong about that. I can't have a mandatory buyback program when that is going to tick off people that vote for her. Of course you got to have it. President Biden ran on assault weapons ban, so why don't you run on it? Are you going to walk that back? In the past, you didn't have a choice because you sat on the stage to get that nomination, and you sat there with 8, 9, 10 people with Tulsi Gabbard and other people last time, and Joe Biden taking your part, and Elizabeth Warren, who thought she could be president, Amy Klobuchar. At that time, you watch the party going after each other, and then after they get the nomination, they try to pivot to the center. So she didn't have that, no vetting, no experience. You know, good debates, bad debates, you can't afford it. She's going to have one debate right now. Hopefully she'll agree to two more, foreign policy included. And she has not been vetted. So she could say whatever she wants right now. But sooner or later, I hope you as voters, you're going to say, if you did change, why? And I don't believe you because you've not done anything like that your entire career. Kevin McCarthy has watched her, as I mentioned. I want to go back to something else he said about her days as AG. Cut 16.
Show what she did as attorney general when it came to crime, letting people out to do more crime, or what she did to California by attorney general. She has a responsibility when it comes to language on initiatives for the public to see. Well, we're putting an initiative on the ballot now, trying to reverse the damage she done because it allows people to go in and steal anything less than $1,000. And why you're seeing all these businesses close up in California.
Yeah, let's see that. And now why is that looting? Is she going to disavow that and say, you know, that smash and grab, which was really coined in her former district? The smash and grab where you go in, take as much as you can, but just keep it under 1,000. Tell you, sir, Social Security guards, don't get involved. We're not giving you a gun anyway. So they don't, and they come, and they leave, and they wreck, and they go. I know for a fact a few of my friends went out golfing, and at which time they had to drop one of my friends off at the airport. So they go, you know, we got a little bit of time. I'm not going to sit at the airport. So let's go back into town and go get a Starbucks. They were gone for 90 seconds, and they heard the smash of a window. They walk out, they run out, their bags are already gone. I had a rent-a-car in a busy street at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And then when they run in to drop the car off, they saw a whole bunch of rent-a-cars with other smashed windows. And they say, yeah, we probably should have told you. This happens constantly. Never leave the car alone. Unless it's in a security guarded parking lot. I mean, that's what she left behind. So if she's going to say that was a big mistake, and I regret that, and the America I see now has taught me a different lesson about need of law and order in the streets, then you can make your decision. I don't believe her. But then you can make a decision, but it'll go to show you that everything we talked about on this show that you believe because you have common sense doesn't mean you're a conservative, means you have common sense, that they realize they can't get elected without showing it or saying it. My worry is they're not going to do it. So when we come back, I'm going to open it up a little bit, talk about other stories you haven't been in the headlines, and also take your calls. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Keep in mind, I know it's only Tuesday, but Saturday at 9 o'clock, we'll have brand new stories, brand new breaking news, and follow all the events of the most intriguing campaign in all of our lifetimes. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis, because man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade. More to know. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen is the most recommended memory support brand by pharmacists.
This is just so heartbreaking, and I'm just so gutted for Jordan. These gymnasts work their entire lives for this moment, and it's supposed to be a celebration. I think it's so unfair. It's so cruel, and I don't think that Jordan should have to give her medal back. The IOC has given more than one medal before, and I think that they should do that now. It's awful.
Of course, because you screwed up. And this is the best I can understand. Correct me if I'm wrong. So Jordan Chiles won the bronze medal, for USA Gymnastics. Congratulations, won bronze. Okay, so she gets the bronze medal. And the way she got it is she went up and looked at her score and realized in terms of difficulty, she should have had a higher score. If you do the math right, she had a higher score. So originally she was out of the medal count. They do the math over again. They said, you're right. You did come in third. You get the bronze medal. Then they came back. The Romanians came back and said, yeah, you protested. Wait, you only have 1 minute to protest the final score. You Americans protested after 1 minute, even though you're right and you had the higher score because the difficulty was not given out correctly in the total. We win because you didn't get there in under a minute. So the International Olympic Committee looks at this and says, yeah, you're right. Give me back the medal after she's already been on the medal stand. Give me back the medal. Why? Because the U.S. came in after a minute. They said, well, we got the tape. It shows I was there complaining 47 seconds after the score was posted. You know what the U.S. You know what the International Olympic Committee said? We're not interested in seeing your tape.
Basically, there's nothing in the rules that say we can reevaluate it after we make our decision. But then also, the IOC has a history of awarding duplicate medals. They could have given them both the bronze medal. There was no reason why they needed to take it back.
And the Romanians actually requested that they share the bronze medal, and the IOC declined.
Makes no sense.
It makes zero sense.
But here's the thing in the big picture. I'm not sure how old she is, but people are going to remember this forever. If she got just a bronze medal in the USA and in the Olympic gymnastic competition, Simone Biles is the story there. And then the controversy with that former gymnast criticizing him, that was the story there. Now all of a sudden, everybody's talking about who came in fourth.
But if you remember, Brian, when she got that bronze, that was the iconic image of the Brazilian.
Yeah.
And then her and Simone bowing down
because
to her.
Because she came back over a series of injuries and ended up winning the gold. And that was great respect.
Correct. That was then also three African-American
so
gymnasts the first time ever.
Yeah.
Yes.
Next. Also in the Olympics. I love this. Flag football will be in the Olympics and baseball will be back. Now, I don't know who else is playing football in the world, but this is totally for Los Angeles, obviously. Can you imagine who's going to be on that team? Number one, I've never seen these guys play flag football, but I'm pretty sure it's the same skill set. Number two, I don't know all the rules. There's some rules about blocking everything, but it's extremely physical, almost no pads. Everybody wants to play in the Olympics, by the way.
So you think a lot of the NFL players will be on the flag football team at the Olympics?
No question.
That would be fascinating.
To me, there's no question. Tyreek Hill has already said, the Miami wide receiver, former Kansas City Chief, I'm sure they're all going to want to do it because it's one thing they don't have. They see LeBron, they see Larry Bird, they see Magic John. They see these guys take their skills, Scottie Scheffler, the best players in the world at their sport. Then they go to the Olympics. And to get there and represent your country, it's pretty cool. Breakdancing's gone. It was fun while it lasted, but it is done. Boxing, one of the Olympics' oldest and most enduring events, could be on the chopping block because of disarray in the sport's international leadership. That is ridiculous. You talk about the legacy of Foreman, Ali, and Frazier, and Sugar Ray Leonard, and Howard Davis Jr., and Leon Spinks, and Holyfield, and Meldrick Taylor, and all these. You got to be kidding me. Boxing's a staple. Straighten out the sport. Don't eliminate the sport.
That is true. But did you see the controversy with the Australian breakdancer?
No, what happened? I heard he's terrible.
It was a joke. I mean, you always say you've never met a dance floor that like
and this is terrible. Just
you could probably do better than the Australian breakdancer. No, apparently it was not.
Well,
apparently she has a PhD in breakdancing, and it's being speculated that this was some kind of performance art piece.
Well, I got to see that. It's too bad we're on radio.
It is. But do you want to hear Dr. Dre making fun of it?
Here's Dr. Dre. Dr. Dre does just want to perform in the 2020 Olympics, coming to a city in 4 short years. He wants to compete in the summer games in the archery event.
But we have him making fun of breakdancing.
Okay, first that, breakdancing.
It's so many great breakdancers, and I don't know why they had this particular person doing that. It was funny. I got some laughs out of it, but what the f***?
I could agree. There's a lot of people that I think around the way that could have watched that and said, okay, I got 4 years to get this together and could really do some damage if breakdancing would come back.
4 years.
That's pretty cool. He says he's good in archery, right? I guess he wants to compete. Go ahead. I mean, you let him practice. I mean, that's not something you lose with age, I don't think.
I don't think so, unless they have all those fancy glasses.
I'll tell you, I'm glad the Olympics is back. France did a fantastic job, it seems. And Los Angeles will light up. You know what they're going to say? Only mass transportation.
It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.